and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. The Chicago Police Department blows its overtime budget, what it means for the city's finances. A new intelligence sharing platform is part of Illinois' efforts to stop organized retail crime.
Fly ball, right center field, Perez got it!
And the White Sox set a new record for futility. A look at how the team got here and what comes next. And now to some of today's top stories. The closure of an almost 100-year-old Illinois state prison is nearly complete. The Illinois Department of Corrections says all men in general population at Stateville Correctional Center have been transferred to other facilities around the state. 24 men remain in custody at the prison's health care unit. In August, a federal judge ordered the incarcerated individuals there moved because of the prison's decrepit conditions. The state had already been planning to close the prison and rebuild it. The court order hastened that plan. Meanwhile, the union representing most workers within IDOC met again today with management for more bargaining over the prison closure's impact on staff. And for more backstory on the Stateville closure, check out tomorrow's Daily Chicagoan newsletter. You can sign up now so you don't miss it at WTTW.com/newsletter. Meanwhile, activists are calling on Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox to vacate some convictions before her term comes to an end.
That is not just the state's attorneys that is corrupt, it's the whole damn system. Yay! So we know what you can do, Kim Fox. We need you to walk out with a bang and sign off on all of these names that are back on y'all's desk right now. Yeah!
The Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression held a rally outside of Fox's office earlier today, calling on her to free survivors of torture and wrongful convictions. They say Fox has moved to vacate 300 wrongful conviction cases since she took office in 2017, but that it's just the tip of the iceberg. Fox is not running for re-election. Instead, voters in November will decide between former appellate judge Eileen O'Neill Burke and former Chicago alderman Bob Fioretti. Some Verizon users in Chicago and across the country were without cell service today after a widespread outage. More than 100,000 customers nationwide reported issues this morning. That's according to Down Detector, which tracks complaints about service outages. At 4 p.m., Verizon apologized for the issue and says its engineers were making progress on the issue and that service has started to resume. Coming up, the rising cost of police overtime. Heather Sharone joins us next to explain.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The city of Chicago's financial condition is dire. And for the sixth consecutive year, the Chicago Police Department has blown its overtime budget. It spent nearly 30% more than city council set aside for the entire year in just 6 months. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharone joins us now with more on the cost of police overtime. Heather, break the numbers down for us. How much did Chicago spend on police overtime during the first half of 2024?
Chicago taxpayers spent $129 million to pay members of the Chicago Police Department to work overtime, even though the city council's budget only gave the department $100 million for overtime for the entire year. And as you said, this is a recurring problem, and it comes even after Chicago Police Superintendent Larry Snelling stopped paying officers to sit downtown with their lights flashing to prevent crime. And it is significantly more than any other city department. In fact, all other the 21 other departments combined for $121 million, and that includes $43 million that went to members of the Chicago Fire Department to work overtime.
So we know the city is facing a massive budget crunch right now. Can they afford to spend this much on overtime?
So it's not clear where this money is going to come from, because if the police department spends just as much in the second half of the year as it did during the first half of the year on overtime, they will end the year spending $258 million. And oh, by the way, we had the Democratic National Convention for a week or two in August, and that meant officers had their regular days off canceled, and there is no doubt that that will cost a significant amount of overtime. Where that money is going to come from, it's not clear, even as Mayor Brandon Johnson has imposed limits on overtime for other departments other than the police and fire department. It's not going to make a huge difference.
Superintendent Larry Snelling has promised the Chicago City Council about a year ago that he would get a handle on employee overtime, vowing to be a lot more fiscally responsible. Did he live up to those promises?
Well, like most things involving Chicago's budget, it's complicated. The city changed the way it reports overtime on its data portal, and Jared Rutecki and I were able to sort of try to compare apples to apples, and we realized that last year, in the first half of 2023, the police department actually spent more than $163 million on overtime. So yes, the city spent about 20% less the first half of this year than it did last year, but that's still a lot of money.
What did Snelling and Johnson have to say about overtime spending?
Well, the mayor's office didn't get back to us, but the police department gave us a statement that said, "We regularly review our use of overtime to ensure it is being used appropriately while balancing the need for public safety. We understand our fiscal responsibility and will continue ensuring overtime is being used to maintain and bolster public safety." We'll keep asking the mayor's office for comment.
As I know you will. Heather Sharon, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read the full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. Up next, the latest on efforts to combat organized retail theft. Illinois law enforcement has a new tool to help tackle organized retail theft. The Illinois Organized Retail Crime Association says it's launching a platform intended to make it easier for agencies to investigate and solve these crimes. And advocates say retail theft is costing Illinois businesses nearly $2 billion every year. Here to talk more about it are Rob Carr, President and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, and Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. Gentlemen, welcome back, and thank you for joining us. Rob, let's start with you, please. If you would, tell us what the Illinois Organized Retail Crime Association is and how it works.
Well, first, it's present in most states already around the nation, so Illinois is just beginning this adoption. But it is an intelligence gathering platform that will enable all of the interested parties in the continuum of trying to fight organized retail crime to gather intelligence, to share intelligence, and hopefully to get ahead of it and give them a better tool. Right now, you know, the Attorney General does task forces, which I'm sure he'll speak about, have brought investigations together. But this will enable local law enforcement, state, federal, as well as asset protection professionals, the Attorney General's office, but state's attorneys as well, to be able to piece together cases that they might not ordinarily be able to piece together now.
And Rob, give us a sense of what role the Illinois Retail Merchants Association plays.
We, in cooperation with the state, we are administering the platform and taking it statewide. So we'll be administering it. We'll be screening the people who apply to participate in it and to ensure they're eligible. We'll be convening a board of a little over 30 people that will be made up of retailers as well as various entities, including law enforcement entities at the state, federal, and local level, to talk about the best policies going forward, how best to use it, and to create educational content for all of those entities and users as well to help, bring better knowledge and skill to this fight.
And I'm going to bring the AG in just a second, but Rob, first, how do you define organized retail crime?
Under state law, it's defined as someone who's stealing with the intent to monetize the product. So you're not necessarily talking about someone who stole a loaf of bread, although that should be something that we don't just minimize. But you are talking about people who are stealing tens or hundreds of things at a time, and they're looking to monetize it for the purposes of funding other illicit activities.
AG, your office established, as we mentioned, the first organized retail crime task force in 2021, where you partnered with law enforcement agencies across the state to investigate and stop individuals who are engaging in this organized retail theft. What do we know about who is committing these crimes, and what trends have you noticed?
Well, it varies. And first off, the task force started out not only as a collaboration of law enforcement, but also collaboration with brick-and-mortar retailers, as well as calling online platforms, which are usually the vehicle to monetize the proceeds of these thefts, to collaborate with law enforcement to solve these problems. With regards to the actors and the trends, unfortunately, it varies. Because of the ease to monetize the proceeds of this organized retail crime, we've seen all sorts of actors, whether it be international actors such as the cartel, organized crime gangs, and other organized crime entities that are domestic, and then local operators who may have initially been utilized as mules in the process, organizing for themselves within municipalities and counties and within states.
Are there specific areas or retailers who are more likely to be targeted than others?
You know, it varies, and historically over the years, we've unfortunately characterized it. It's been characterized in the media as something that happens by way of smash and grabs in urban areas, but this is happening in rural areas. Many of our operations, our stings have been, it's been throughout our state. We were happy to, I myself traveled the state along with individuals from loss prevention and with regards to different brick and mortar retailers to educate local law enforcement, prosecutor's offices as to the importance of focusing on this and distinguishing it from ordinary retail theft. As Rob said, we're not ignoring ordinary retail theft, but this is something that is usually connected to other crime, like human trafficking, drug trafficking, gun trafficking, and even terrorism in some instances. And so it's just critically important for us to value it for what it is and to focus.
AG, to that point, what are some of the ripple effects of this kind of crime?
Well, you get, particularly with seniors, right? You know, seniors are less likely to be shopping on online platforms. They like to shop in person. It's my birthday today, so I qualify as one of those seniors, and I like to shop in person, right? But I want to feel safe in doing so. And to the extent that, if you think of our Magnificent Mile, for instance, to the extent that people don't feel comfortable shopping in person because some of these brazen acts, it impacts not just the retailer, but it impacts the city at large in terms of its tourism. We've just celebrated a very successful GNC where law enforcement did a tremendous job. We want to sustain that. We want to sustain that over time, and that's why, in addition to the legislation, in addition to the platform that Rob has championed, we have also, the legislature has also given us funding to incentivize and support local law enforcement to focus on organized retail crime. And for instance, the Cook County Sheriff's have done a tremendous job supplementing the Chicago Police Department in our central business district.
There's also, obviously, there's the loss of the items that get stolen, right? So the business is losing money, not being able to sell it. But there's also the loss of the tax revenue to the state because, again, those items can't be sold. Rob, today you all are launching Aurora. It's a platform to help share this intel. We've been teasing it during this discussion. But tell us how it works, please.
The Aurora is actually the platform itself that is underneath ORCA. It's the technology piece of it. And how it works is once people are screened to be in it, they can upload incidents that are occurring in their area. It could be the pictures of the individuals. It could be the type of car, license plate that they're driving or utilizing. It could be the types of merchandise that they're targeting or the methods that they're using. So it's a variety of factors that go into it that enables now others to see, okay, we have a group that's targeting these items in this area, and it puts them on alert. It puts law enforcement on alert. It helps law enforcement, for example, at the local level, who might find a car with, you know, 10 items in it and not think anything of it and realize, wait a second, we saw on the Illinois Orca, you know, platform that similar items were stolen 30 miles away. And so they can start to piece these things together, contact the attorney general or someone else and start that investigation. So I think it helps constrain that and provide additional points of reference for law enforcement.
Okay, that's a good place to leave it. Rob, I know that Orca is also going to be working on implementing it with regards to getting businesses and agencies, retailers, loss prevention experts on board with including that intel on Aurora. So we look forward to learning more about it down the road and how it goes. For now, my thanks to Rob Carr at the Illinois Retail Merchants Association and, of course, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. And happy birthday, AG.
Thank you.
Up next, a historically brutal season for the White Sox and their fans. We recap the season and look ahead right after this. White Sox may have won five of their last six games, but it was all too little, too late. The 2024 White Sox officially set a new record for Major League Baseball futility on Friday in their loss to Detroit, which became their 121st of the season. Just how has a team that only 3 years ago won the American League Central Division title fallen so far so fast? Joining us now to delve into that question is Lamond Pope, White Sox reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for joining us, Lamond.
Thank you.
Okay, so expectations, maybe they weren't that high after they lost 101 games in 2023, but this wasn't just bad. It was bad, bad. What were the factors that sort of created this embarrassment for the White Sox and fans?
Yeah, the season, they started off the year 3-22, and part of that was because three of their star players, Eloy Jimenez, Luis Robert Jr., and Yoan Moncada, they each got injured in early April, and those were three guys that they were counting on to be really important parts of that offense. And so when those three guys went out, everyone else on the offensive side just started struggling and trying to do too much to kind of compensate for those losses. And it was also a situation where if you're taking a look at it with the White Sox, trying to figure on out what they were going to do as far as when they started the 3-22 second season, they had to kind of play perfect every single night to if they're going to win a ball game. And so when they started losing,
they started losing. It sounds like, you know, it's like a snowball, right? It just kind of picked up speed from there. They made some changes. For you, what's it been like, you know, as a reporter to cover the team in this season, being around the clubhouse?
It's just an astonishing year. I mean, you know, the fact that this ball club, as you said, they had this opportunity to kind of show, you know, losing 101 games last year, kind of coming on back and trying to figure out what they're going to be as a ball club. And knowing that, you know, the expectations were going to be low. I mean, this is a club that came on in knowing that the expectations weren't going to be high, but they had the opportunity to kind of show what they were going to be made of. But they kind of fell on flat. Going on into the All-Star break with 71 losses, the most in Major League Baseball history, coming on out with the 21-game losing streak after that, and then losing continuing, having 100 losses by the end of August, and then obviously reaching the 120 losses by San Diego, and then the 121st loss there in Detroit.
Yeah, and we're just looking at some not-so-good plays by some of the players there as you're talking. And I'm no baseball expert, but I can tell that wasn't good. Are there any positives to take away from this season?
From the pitching standpoint, Garrett Crochet, he was their lone all-star. He made the transition from being a relief pitcher to being a starter, and he was really good. And then you had Eric Fetty, another pitcher who came over from the Korean baseball organization. He performed pretty well before going ahead and eventually getting traded, but there really weren't all that often, really weren't a whole lot. I mean, offensively, the team was really bad. They really struggled. They're last in several offensive categories. And so, you know, back with, you know, Luis Robert Jr., he was a guy who was an all-star previously. He had a down year, struck out a lot. Guys like Andrew Benintendi, he eventually had 20 home runs, but he struggled early on in the year, and so he was able to kind of pick it up later on in the year, but they really needed guys like Andrew Vaughn and Andrew Benintendi when those other guys got hurt early in the season to kind of pick things up, and they weren't able to, and that led to a lot of the losses early on in the season.
White Sox owner and chairman Jerry Reinsdorf sent a letter to fans yesterday. I think it probably happened when everybody was paying attention to the Bears game. Here's a little bit of what he had to say. Quote, by all measures, our on-field performance this season was a failure. As the leader of this organization, that is my ultimate responsibility. There are no excuses. I want to thank you for continuing to support the team throughout what was an embarrassing season. You all deserved better. So Reinsdorf says that he ultimately, he accepts the responsibility, but a lot of the reporting says that he has been a large part of the problem. Can he turn things around, and is that criticism fair?
Yeah, I think the criticism is fair. I think the big thing is, you know, words can only get so far, and so, like, what are you going to do? You know, as far as it, is it going to be diving into the analytics? Is it going to be diving into international scouting? What are going to be the steps that you take as far as getting this ball club back and going in the right direction? The first thing is trying to figure out who the next manager is going to be. You know, names like Skip Schumacher have appeared. Grady Sizemore, who had stepped on in as the interim manager after Pedro Grifol was let go. He, you know, the wins weren't showing on up, but he had the team playing energetically. You know, the guys in the clubhouse had a lot of respect for him, and so he's someone that the team is under consideration, but it'll be really interesting just to see what direction the ball club goes in.
As we mentioned, it was just 3 years ago that the Sox won the AL Central, one of the most exciting teams in baseball at the time, and thought to be on the brink of real success. How did they fall so quickly in 3 years?
I mean, that's the astonishing thing, right? I mean, the fact that here's this club that was so young, so talented, and it just seemed like, well, injuries played a major factor. It seemed like year in and year out, when you're depending on guys like Moncada and Eloy and Luis to kind of come on through, and those guys get injured year in and year out, then other guys have to step on up, and that hasn't been the case. You know, they've had pretty solid pitching, but other guys in other roles, the relief, the bullpen hasn't been all that solid. You know, they have had to use guys in different bullpen situations, and so what, it's one of those things where, you know, those windows close so quickly in Major League Baseball, and so you can be on top 1 second, and then where they are right now, just in a flash.
Yeah, and they get a long season too. Like, and it feels like, you know, it kind of drags out, and I'm impressed that, you know, that the players were able to keep doing it despite it all. Reinsdorf said, you know, in his letter to, well, actually, you already talked about, like, the new hiring manager, but I wanted to ask about the fans, actually. A lot of them are pointing to the reappointment of Tony La Russa back in 2021 as sort of the beginning of the problems when he became manager then. What's your take on that?
Well, it was surprising when they went that direction. A lot of people thought it was going to be A.J. Hinch, who now has led the Tigers to the postseason. But it's also a situation where, you know, that first year they did make the playoffs under Tony, and so when there were some injuries, they were able to overcome that. Next year they were right around 500. They actually were 581-81, and so, you know, it became a situation where Tony had the health issues. They went on over to Pedro Grifol. They had some of that talent still there last year, and everything just sort of bottomed on out with 101 loss season. And then this year, when they entered on into the year, they knew that they had to get off to a solid start. And the fact that they started so poorly, it sort of snowballed, as you said, and it got to a point where they need to make a change at the manager situation, and that's how they've led to what where we're at right now.
All right, so 2025. I'm hesitant to ask, but expectations, any?
Not particularly, really, no, because, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do as far as free agency. I don't really anticipate them spending a whole lot from that standpoint. Garrett Crochet, who was their all-star, he'll likely be traded as well, and so it's going to be a situation where, you know, you have some young pitchers, Sean Burke, Drew Thorpe, some young guys that got the opportunity last year.
Right.
They're going to have the chance again, but you know, you're still going to be really young, and so
we'll have to tune in 2025. We'll have you back to tell us more about it. Lamon Pope at the Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this Monday night. Be sure to sign up for our newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And while you're there, check out our website for stories you may have missed today, like our countdown to Christmas. We know, it's early. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Candidates for vice president face off tomorrow on the debate stage. Our Spotlight Politics team on that and more. And before we go, Kris Kristofferson died this weekend at the age of 88. In 1975, the singer-songwriter performed on soundstage. Here's a look back at his performance of Me and Bobby McGee. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
I was blue and sad while Bobby sang blue. Them windshield wipers slapping time in. Bobby clapping hands, we finally sang a every song that driver knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and Bobby McGee. From the coal mines of Kentucky to the California sun, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. Standing right beside me, Lord, through everything I've done, every match kept me from cold. Then somewhere near so
closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to give back to its community in Chicago and beyond.